The last time that Claire Hobber was in the studio with me, we were talking about a book that she'd recommended called Milkman by Anna Burns, which of course was the winner for that year's Man Booker Prize. And this time Claire suggested that we look at A Gentleman in Moscow, which is a book I hadn't read. I've now not only read the book, but I've also listened to the audiobook, which is quite an interesting way of doing it. It's by an American author called Amor Towles. Is that right? T-O-W-L-E-S?
Yes, I believe Towles is the recommended pronunciation. And he is effectively American aristocracy, as close as they get in America to aristocracy, an old Boston family, then Ivy League University, then he became an investment banker, then he retired at an enviably early age to write fiction. And he has already had one previous bestseller called The Rules of Civility. I'm not sure whether it's a bestseller here, but possibly in the States. And what I find remarkable is how similar, really, his CV is to that of his hero and protagonist in A Gentleman in Moscow, Count Alexander Rostov, whose CV goes, recipient of the Order of St. Andrew, member of the Jockey Club, master of the hunt.
Yes, and of course the cultured nature of this man, Count Rostov, is very important to the tale. It sets out why he is in the situation that he's in when we start the book, but it also follows him all the way through because he's very well read. He's had a life of leisure. In the pre-revolutionary days, it was a life of parties and all the things that went with that. Tell us how we start this book, because it actually starts in a strange way with a court transcript, because he's being tried in 1922, I think, by the Communist Party.
Clearly, the expectation in a time of such purges and so many executions is that a patently aristocratic man brought before this committee will not be coming out again alive. So we have a court transcript, and it seems that the reason in this trial that he is not executed is that he has done one good thing, which would make it, or good from the point of view of the Communist Party, which would make it very difficult to execute him. And he has authorship of a poem which appears to be inciting the revolution. So it's something that perhaps inspired revolutionaries and that they held dear to their heart. And this is attributed to our hero, Count Alexander Rostov. So he is not executed. He is instead condemned to house arrest, permanent house arrest. And his house, as it turns out to be, is the place where he is currently residing. The Metropole Hotel, a magnificent and very luxurious hotel right in the centre of Moscow, opposite the Bolshoi, close to the Kremlin. But all that will no longer be accessible to Count Rostov, for he is to remain indoors and never to come out again at pain of being shot.
At 6:30 on the 21st of June 1922, when Count Alexander Ilyich Rostov was escorted through the gates of the Kremlin onto Red Square, it was glorious and cool. Drawing his shoulders back without breaking stride, the Count inhaled the air like one fresh from a swim. The sky was the very blue that the cupolas of St. Basil's had been painted for. Their pinks, greens and golds shimmered as if it were the sole purpose of a religion to cheer its divinity. Even the Bolshevik girls conversing before the windows of the State Department store seemed dressed to celebrate the last days of spring. "Hello, my good man," the Count called to Fyodor at the edge of the square. "I see the blackberries have come in early this year." Giving the startled fruit seller no time to reply, the Count walked briskly on, his waxed moustaches spread like the wings of a gull. Passing through Resurrection Gate, he turned his back on the lilacs of the Alexander Gardens and proceeded towards Theatre Square, where the Hotel Metropole stood in all its glory. When he reached the threshold, the Count gave a wink to Pavel, the afternoon doorman, and turned with a hand outstretched to the two soldiers trailing behind him. "Thank you, gentlemen, for delivering me safely. I shall no longer be in need of your assistance."
Circumstances are not at all as they were when he left, from having one of the best suites in the hotel full of his favourite furniture and family memorabilia. He is consigned to a loft, a room that was previously reserved for servants, and with a low ceiling. He, we are told, is 6'3", and the ceiling doesn't really accommodate that. And it is a huge reduction in his circumstances. So although he has been given his life, he is not to spend it in the luxury that he has been used to. And I think this is the point where we first really see the call made on his character and his reserves. And it's quite a big call. He prides himself. He's very cultured. He has a huge reservoir of knowledge and education to call on. Also, a code of good behaviour and elegant behaviour and a face that must be preserved under all circumstances. I think this is the code under which he lives. And this is now going to be a challenge. When you're being treated like a servant, can you behave like a count?
The crowded confusion of furniture gave the Count's little domain the look of a consignment shop in the Arbat. In a room this size, he could have made do with a single high-back chair, a single bedside table, and a single lamp. He could have made do without his grandmother's Limoges altogether. And the books? All of them, he had said with such bravado. But in the light of day, he had to admit that this instruction had been prompted less by good sense than by a rather childish impulse to impress the bellhops and put the guards in their place. For the books were not even to the Count's taste. His personal library of majestic narratives by the likes of Balzac, Dickens, and Tolstoy had been left behind in Paris. The books the bellhops had lugged to the attic had been his father's, and, devoted as they were to studies of rational philosophy and the science of modern agriculture, each promised heft and threatened impenetrability.
And he sort of got used fairly quickly to the idea that his life of leisure would continue, albeit in a very small space.
Yes, I think immediately we see that he uses his ingenuity to make his situation in the servants' rooms as good as it can be. But after a time of living this leisured and frankly somewhat pointless life in a cramped space, he begins to lose his sense of himself and his motivation to go on living. After all, his whole class has been rendered pointless in Russia and to an extent wiped out or sent away to France. And within the hotel, similarly, he has an easy enough existence, but no point. So there's a particular episode which brings this to a head where he is attracted to a young actress who is passing through, and that passage where they become attracted to one another is crackling. It's very much worth reading. And she summons him to her room, but afterwards she dismisses him just as if he were of a lower order. And I think this forces a crisis, and he sees that he is no longer a person who is respected, who simply by his very being commands respect and has rank, and he begins to feel a little bit like a ghost.
Even if a person generally frowned upon rude and abrupt behaviour, under the circumstances he might have to admit a certain rough justice upon finding himself in an empty hallway with his shoes in his hand and his shirt untucked, as the woman he's just left falls soundly asleep. For, if a man has had the good fortune to be plucked from the crowd by an impetuous beauty, shouldn't he expect to be sent on his way without ceremony? Well, maybe so, but standing in the empty corridor, across from a half-eaten bowl of borscht, the Count felt less like a philosopher than a ghost. Yes, a ghost, thought the Count, as he moved silently down the hall. Like Hamlet's father roaming the ramparts of Elsinore after the midnight watch, or like Akaki Akakievich, that forsaken spirit of Gogol's, who, in the wee hours, haunted the Kalinkin Bridge in search of his stolen coat. Why is it that so many ghosts prefer to travel the halls of night? Ask the living, and they will tell you that these spirits either have some unquenched desire, or an unaddressed grievance that stirs them from their sleep and sends them out into the world in search of solace.
He has to pull himself together. He has a decision to take. One thing that is possible at the Metropole is taking his own life because he can get out onto the roof. In fact, that is the closest he ever comes to escaping his confinement, is the open space of the roof where he's under the sky and an elderly caretaker with his apiary of bees is also up there to provide more interest. But there is a point where Count Rostov would happily, or perhaps I should say unhappily, have thrown himself from that roof. He needs to take a decision about whether that will be his ending or whether he can find a future. And then, tactfully, without describing the interior process that Count Rostov goes through, We have a gap and a new section begins. And at the beginning of the new section, we find that he has indeed found a role for himself, not one that you would expect of an aristocrat, but something which gives meaning to his life, uses his already existing talents of being able to seat people very appropriately so that nobody quarrels and people have plenty to say to one another. And his tact and his knowledge of food and fine dining, he becomes the head waiter in the prestigious Metropole Hotel, the Boyarsky Restaurant.
And there he has colleagues. He has the chef, and the third person in this triumvirate is...
It's the maître d' called André.
They've known each other for a long time because he's lived in this hotel for many years, I think. So he's very comfortable in there, but as you say, he's now found a role. It's not that he needs to work for money because he's actually got quite a lot of wealth with him. He's not actually poor. No. Not struggling for
he's
money.
He's not poor in terms of money, but money. Maybe in terms of everything else at the beginning.
Yes. Yeah. The one thing he would find very difficult is to be isolated. As you say, he creates a role for himself, or has found a role, at a time when all sorts of strange things are happening, aren't they? Because this is, after all, we are now moving through the 20s and into the 30s. This is the Soviet Union establishing itself as a totalitarian state. Stalin is in control, or as he's nicknamed So-So, which is not one I'd come across before. And it's becoming that very intense workers' proletariat with odd meetings that are going on in the ballroom where you bring together the management of the tractor associations of the Soviet Union or something equally absurd. And all these things are going on. And there's a context underneath this all the time, which is that we're passing through different phases of history. The book, in fact, goes from the time before the First World War and before the Revolution. But this tale of Rostov, as we know it, is from the 20s through the 30s, 40s, through the Second World War and into the 50s. So what you've actually got there is a history book underlying very much a person-driven narrative and a character that's tremendous in the variety that he brings to us. I think I found him fascinating. And that urbanity, that suave experience. And yet there are several surprises that he encounters on the way, aren't there? There are lots of different things that he's not used to.
It's clear that you already understand the history of the Soviet Union. If I don't, I know merely that one revolution followed another and that there were constant changes of regime and you would be in one minute and out and sent to Siberia the next. And we see a degree of that. And there are actually sort of witty footnotes which tell us a bit more. We kind of see the manifestation within the metropole, within this closed microcosm of the metropole, in what's happening and what's asked of the count. So when he first starts being head waiter, there is a representative of the Communist Party within the hotel, nicknamed the Bishop because of his lugubrious manner. And he insists that all the labels are taken off the wine so that nobody, specifically the count, can't boast of their knowledge of fine wines, and everybody becomes like the proletariat. The proletariat is the right way to be. And I notice that by the end of the book, that a party official is coming in, and instead of trying to make the count more like the proletariat, he is asking the count to explain to him fine manners and comportment so that he may behave more like an aristocrat. So we see the corruption from the original mission of the Communist Party in that. So we're tracking that. In parallel with that, there's the dilapidation of the Metropole Hotel, just the occasional reference to threadbare carpets and economies that are being made and repairs that are being made. And we track as well through the occasional references to the Count's exercise routine every morning, how there were way more squat thrusts at the beginning of the novel than there are by the end. In fact, I'm not sure there are any. I think that might be a little too vigorous by the end of the novel when Count Rostov is nearing 60. And alongside that, the most fascinating thing of all, however, I think, is the Count's character development. When you look for meaning in a novel, you go, well, maybe it gives us a picture of the communist regime, maybe it does this, maybe it does that. But always key to a novel's success is whether there's some character development. And that's very much the case with Count Rostov. So we hear stories about his past and we see how he behaves at the beginning of his internment. And several times the word smug or smugly is used in connection with him. He is fortunate enough to have been brought up with education, wealth, and one imagines him also to be good looking and charming. And he takes for granted these advantages and slightly looks down his nose at anybody who has them, which is how he falls into trouble with the bishop. There's another whole incident, which is too long to report, where he falls foul of an officer of cavalry who later on comes back to blight his family because of the way Count Rostov dealt with him smugly. So we need to see Count Rostov moving out of that. And as he grasps his role and works to the advantage of all in the restaurant, and as around him, the workers who originally were his servants, I think he was always on friendly terms with them, treated them well, was scrupulously polite, but they actually become much more like his family and his best friends as the novel goes on through. And he comes to value them as equals. In all this, we see his character developing.
We talked about André, the maitre d', and the head chef. And when the three of them get together, they create the most perfect of the old dishes that they used to know in the old days.
At 1 in the morning, the conspirators took their seats. On the table before them were a single candle, a loaf of bread, a bottle of rosé, and 3 bowls of bouillabaisse. After exchanging a glance, the three men dipped their spoons into the stew in unison. But for Emile, the gesture was a sleight of hand. For when André and the Count raised their spoons to their mouths, Emile let his hover above the bowl, intent upon studying his friend's expressions at the very first taste. Fully aware that he was being watched, the Count closed his eyes to attend more closely to his impressions. How to describe it? One first tastes the broth, that simmered distillation of fish bones, fennel, and tomatoes, with their hearty suggestions of Provence. One then savours the tender flakes of haddock and the briny resilience of the mussels which have been purchased on the docks from the fishermen. One marvels at the boldness of the oranges arriving from Spain and the absinthe poured in the taverns. And all of these various impressions are somehow collected, composed and brightened by the saffron, that essence of summer sun which, having been harvested in the hills of Greece and packed by mule to Athens, has been sailed across the Mediterranean in a felucca. In other words, with the very first spoonful, one finds oneself transported to the port of Marseille, where the streets teem with sailors, thieves, and Madonnas, with sunlight and summer, with languages and life. The Count opened his eyes. Magnifique, he said. André, who had put down his spoon, brought his elegant hands together in a respectful show of silent applause. Beaming, the chef bowed to his friends and then joined them in their long-awaited meal.
These characters develop as well over time because we are dealing with 30-plus years of history and people grow older during that time. I think it's the chef, I can't remember the chef or the maitre d'. As they get older, they get physically weaker. You know, ailments afflict them, which is absolutely true to life. It's not just him, although he's the central character and you can't get away from him. And I found him fascinating in lots of different ways. And I was sort of thinking, it's very English in many ways because we're used to the aristocracy. Of course, the Russian aristocracy was probably very similar to the British aristocracy, so there are probably lots of links there. There are other people that come in. I mean, you talked about the actress that he has this occasional affair with, if you can put it that way, when she turns up. And she goes through a history of her own because the world outside in Russia, Soviet Union, was very tricky. You had to make sure you didn't say the wrong thing at the wrong time, particularly under the rule of Stalin. But there are others. There's a child that comes into his life. In fact, he has to look after her.
He is certainly by that stage old to be the father of a young child.
That's right.
But he isn't the father of the young child. He is acting as the godfather of the young child. Yes. A great deal of humour is drawn from that because for all his many accomplishments, playing with a little girl is not one of them. And gently, the people around him with whom he works instruct him in games and activities that might make a child happy, and he learns to nurture this other little human being and to raise her. And in fact, we see that as he behaves well and wins through his circumstances, he's blessed with a family of sorts. It's not a conventional family, but he grows to have a child and very good friends who are like brothers and sisters to him. I think that is one of the crowning points, that you see that he has succeeded in becoming a nicer person and a useful person, and that is success measured in very different terms than it would have been before the revolution, I guess.
I give up, he said. Without a hint of gloating, Sophia accepted his surrender. Then she jumped off her chair and walked toward him. He stepped a little out of her way, assuming that she must have hid the thimble somewhere in the bookcase. But she didn't approach the bookcase. Instead, she stopped in front of him, reached into his jacket pocket, and withdrew the thimble. The Count was aghast. In fact, he actually sputtered. But, Sophia, that's not fair. Sophia studied the Count with curiosity. Why is it not fair? Always with that damnable why. Because it's not, replied the Count. But you said we could hide it anywhere in the room. That's just it, Sophia. My pocket wasn't in the room. Your pocket was in the room when I hid the thimble, and it was in the room when you hunted. And as the Count gazed into her innocent little face, it all became clear. He, a master of nuance and sleight of hand, had been played at every turn. When she had called him back to insist he not peek, and had so sweetly tugged at his sleeve, that was a ploy to mask the slipping of the thimble into his pocket. And the moving of the furniture, as the 200th second approached, pure theatre, a ruthless case of dissembling, and even as he searched, there she sat, clutching her little dolly in its bright blue dress, without ever once betraying her wiles. The Count took one step back and bowed at the waist.
I think it's a lovely book, and I found the ending quite charming, quite surprising, and obviously we're not going to talk about it.
I think one of the problems with this book is that I certainly was disposed to fall utterly in love with Count Rostov, and I imagine many readers will be. I believe there are plans to televise it. It will be a very hard set of shoes to fill to be Count Rostov. Mm. I heard people dismiss it because it's witty and appears to be light and charming, but it's asking a lot of questions about values, about what actually matters to us. What is civilization? What do we need to persist? What do we need to still be us? How do we need to move on? And I think under cover of a very witty, urbane, erudite set of prose, which is a pleasure to read, it is asking serious questions.
Thank you very much, Claire.
Thank you, Rob.
Our thanks, as always, to Caliber Audio for providing us with a CD of this title so that we can take extracts from it. The music accompanying this edition of the Talking Bookshelf is called Good Times. It was composed and recorded by Goffby of Kenilworth, who's very generously given us permission to use his music.